Welcome back to season 2 of our student-led IIIW podcast, Sustainably Speaking Beyond the Aula. I'm your host Marlene of this knowledge-sharing episode that covers the private sector engagement in climate adaptation and resilience in developing countries, later referred to as A&R. As you might know, the majority of subjects addressed here at the IIIE are related to climate mitigation, aimed at minimizing environmental impact, which is really important. But we cannot neglect the fact that we are already facing climate change right now, with recent studies showing that we already breached the 1.5-degree threshold from the Paris Agreement for the past 12 months. Summers with mega droughts and unstoppable fires or destructive floodings, something that you might have heard more often lately, which is not only happening in neighborhoods, but especially in least developed countries. What comes to your mind when you think about climate adaptation solutions? Most of us think about it as a public good, such as flood controls that are provided by public institutions. But did you know that 10 to 18 times more A&R finance for developing countries is needed compared to the current international public adaptation finance flows? That is only one fact that shows that we need to get the private sector engaged in the topic, which means for-profit businesses that are not owned or operated by the government. With this episode, we aim to shed light on this side of the A&R story and will answer the following questions. What is climate adaptation and resilience? What are some concrete examples of solutions provided by the private sector? And what are the challenges and barriers to secure funding for private sector projects? To answer these guiding questions, I'm extremely delighted to welcome two guests today in the podcast, Rashmi Yavaha, who I got to know during a consultancy project for UNIDO, the UN Industrial Development Organization, which was included in the Environmental Management and Policy Masters EMP program here in Lund, and Helen Robert, an EMP alumni who graduated in 2016. Would you like to introduce yourself and let us know what you do in your jobs?
Yes, kia ora. I'm Helen Robert. So I'm a senior consultant at a small environmental consulting company called ECO, based in London, and I work from Aotearoa, New Zealand. So we work mainly in LDCs, least developing countries around the world, and I focus on the Pacific so that my colleagues in Europe don't have to wake up at ridiculous hours to connect with clients. I must say I'm pretty happy to be here. I jump at any opportunity to get involved in any IIIE activities, and I totally loved my time studying at Sweden at the INSTI. So thanks for inviting me to the podcast. It's a total privilege. Just a bit more about what we do. So our company does a range of activities for our clients in the environment and climate change space. We help our clients get funding for their projects, whether it be through providing training to build capacity so that they're equipped to access funding for environmental or climate change projects, or hired to design and develop proposals for the likes of the Global Environment Facility, the Green Climate Fund, or the Adaptation Fund. We develop strategies or even evaluations of projects. Our clients range from governments and LDCs, UN organizations, multilateral development banks such as the World Bank, or international NGOs.
Hello, podcast listeners. Thank you for inviting me, Marlene. This is Rashmi Jawahar. I work in the Climate Technology and Innovation Division at UNIDO, which is the UN Organization for Industrial Development. And we are based in beautiful Vienna in Austria. A lot of my work is centered around innovating, negotiating, as well as coordinating with diverse stakeholders from various sectors to design and implement affordable, accessible, and appropriate projects in climate adaptation and resilience innovation.
Fun fact, ECO, we've worked quite a bit with UNIDO, so it's lovely to be on this podcast with Rashmi. Yeah, I'm excited about today. I'm really looking forward to hopefully enlightening you on some challenges with funding adaptation projects, particularly by the private sector and with a focus on our work with the Green Climate Fund.
And on my side, on today's podcast, I'm very excited to share insights from my work. I specialize in crafting technical cooperation projects that empower startups and small and medium-sized enterprises in the Global South. Together, we're shaping climate adaptation and resilience products, services, and business models, while also strengthening connections across the wider ecosystem. So let's dive into some real-life lessons and experiences from this journey today.
Wow, it's really an honor to have you both here in the podcast today. And before we start talking about concrete solutions and financing of these solutions, Helen, how is adaptation and resilience defined, and what is the difference between those two?
Thanks, Marilyn. I mean, to start with the basics, when we're working on climate change projects, they're either adaptation projects or mitigation projects, or even cross-cutting, which is a bit of both. So in relation to adaptation, as we're all aware, today we're faced with more and more extreme weather events and will continue to do so in the future to a greater extent. Adaptation is about putting measures or infrastructure in place to better deal with these extreme weather events. So what might that concretely look like? That might be planting mangrove forests to improve resilience to storm surges that might happen during a tropical cyclone, building or reinforcing infrastructure such as bridges so they can cope with higher river levels, setting up early warning weather information and communication systems, or even farmers planting new drought-resilient crops. These are all examples of adaptation projects, and these projects should be helping people, economies, and the environment bounce back from extreme weather events. Another way of saying this, they should help build resilience to these events. Just quickly to make it clear, the difference between adaptation and mitigation is that mitigation is really about reducing emissions. So that would be a project, say, looking at improving public transport, which will reduce emissions from private vehicle fleet usage, or installing solar farms to reduce dependence on fossil fuel energy generation, etc.
Hearing about early warning systems and also the bridges, that's kind of a good bridge to our next section, which will cover the diverse landscape of A&R solutions. Because indeed, when I thought about climate adaptation before the consultancy project with Onido, it was mainly public goods that I thought of, like dams or river protection. But however, that was a really key learning for me, that the pool of solutions is so much broader, and that a lot of solutions for climate adaptation are also tailored for the benefit of individuals and also provided by businesses. So Rashmi, you are working a lot with local businesses that provide A&R solutions. Why is it important to engage small and medium-sized enterprises, so SMEs or entrepreneurs, as solutions providers?
Yeah, thank you, Marlene. So SMEs are really the backbone of local economies, providing vital technologies, products, and services to communities, even in the remote areas. So with SMEs making up nearly 95% of the global private sector, their deep integration into local economies gives them a profound understanding of market dynamics as well as business opportunities. Moreover, SMEs' strong networks within local communities foster trust and drive higher adoption rates of their adaptation solutions. So this agility enables them to respond swiftly to changing circumstances, making them invaluable in addressing challenges faced by vulnerable communities. So these SMEs, by offering homegrown, affordable, and context-specific climate adaptation solutions, hold a unique advantage over larger enterprises in effectively meeting the needs of the communities worldwide.
Wow, that's a huge role. Do you have some concrete examples of A&R solutions that are provided by the private sector? I mean, especially SMEs?
Of course. So it can range from sustainable agroforestry to emergency financial services or blue economy solutions, for example. So SMEs are really at the forefront of innovation today. For example, I can just share what a blue economy solution could look like. So it could be solutions that protect the ecosystem, help the coastal zone and natural resource management to be better managed. They could also include solutions to sustainably manage, conserve, or restore the health and resilience of coastal, marine, and river ecosystems, seafood processing and distribution, fisheries, aquaculture, and mariculture, as well as algae culture. So, like blue economy, I would like to give you some examples from other sectors as well. For example, the food and agriculture value chain. So there are examples that we're seeing of business models ranging from targeting sustainable livelihoods, agroforestry, land restoration, for example. And for financial services, it could range from emergency payments, remittances, insurance, for example, like crop insurance, disaster recovery savings and credit. And when I mentioned urban adaptation and resilience solutions, we are seeing a lot of solutions coming from sustainable building materials, solutions for cooling, solutions for strengthening flood defenses, etc. And similarly, for health, we are seeing solutions that are targeting disaster care and emergency services like ambulances and access to medicines, cold chain for vaccines and other medications, cooling shelters, and efficient heating and cooling solutions as well. In a nutshell, climate adaptation and resilience innovations are really broad and intersectional. They all have a diverse range of solutions, and all of these solutions could contribute to adaptation and resilience. So it's very important to identify how these solutions contribute to the adaptation and resilience rationale. So if you do that, I think the solutions would qualify in to help these vulnerable communities to cope with the climate crisis.
Wow, I'm always impressed again by the broad field of solutions. How is the relation of these solutions to mitigation and development projects?
So what we are seeing today is that climate adaptation and resilience innovation is nearly 10 years behind climate mitigation efforts. So the focus really right now for us is to test and build innovations and prove their business models so that those solutions can be scaled up across these various markets that we support. And at this point, we are still trying to learn about the solutions' interconnectedness with mitigation aspects as well, which is very crucial also to attract the climate mitigation actors also into this space to have a broader understanding.
This was definitely a great overview of services and products provided by SMEs. And now the question is how they fund these solutions. And one important finance provider for adaptation and projects is the Green Climate Fund, GCF. Helen, you mentioned that you have several touch points with them in your work. Could you tell us a bit more about them, about their strategy, and what they do for climate adaptation?
Yes, so I mentioned previously that we work a lot on designing projects for our clients to get funding through the Green Climate Fund. This is just a bit of background. The GCF was established in 2010 and is the largest multilateral climate fund and mechanism to support developing countries to reduce their emissions and respond to climate change, so adaptation. Climate justice underpins the establishment of the GCF. So ultimately, there's a pool of money that's available to developing countries who are bearing the brunt of climate change that is funded by developed countries who have contributed the most to emissions. Many developed countries put money into this pool. So New Zealand committed US 15 million in 2023, which is quite small relative to the big economies such as the US. Now, when it comes to this question around the balance between adaptation and mitigation, as we've touched on previously, around, I think Rashmi mentioned that there's really less funding for adaptation compared to mitigation projects. And when we look at climate finance globally, around 60% of funded projects are mitigation projects, whereas 40% are adaptation projects. So that's USD 7.2 billion versus 4.8 billion. So, why is that? One important factor that tips the balance in favor of mitigation projects is the ease to engage the private sector versus adaptation projects. The GCF is quite special in a way that it specifically aims for a 50% balance between the two. So their goal is really like 50% of the projects they finance are mitigation, 50% are adaptation. They're still a bit off. GCF's strategy to improve that balance is attracting the private sector to bridge that funding gap. But I think we'll dive into that more a bit later.
So now we heard about GCF as a finance provider, but to close the chapter for actors in the financing ecosystem overall, Rashmi, given your daily involvement in securing financing for local businesses, which other entities do you encounter within the A&R financing domain?
Yes, now let's talk about the other players in the game. So beyond the Green Climate Fund, we also have a variety of actors involved in funding climate adaptation and resilience innovation. And this group seems to be growing over the years. So they include well-known organizations like the Global Environment Facility and the Adaptation Fund, as well as bilateral donors. But it doesn't stop there. Financial institutions, investors, and even family offices and foundations like the IKEA Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, David and Lucille Packard Foundation, as well as Rockefeller, are some of the few names that are already starting to contribute to drive change in this space.
So as we can already conclude from Helen's insights, is that mitigation projects get much more funding than adaptation projects. So for GCF, it was 60-40%. But actually worldwide, we see that only 5% of global climate finance flows went to adaptation projects in 21-22. And thereof, only 4% were from the private sector in 2020. So now the question is, why is it harder to find funding, especially from the private sector, for adaptation? And which are the challenges and barriers to secure funding?
Yes, so it's hard to get funding from the private sector into climate change adaptation for a number of reasons, but some that stick out are the risk factor and the lack of a business case or return on investment. So we've done quite a bit of research on this topic as a part of our GCF insights, which we publish a couple of times a year, where we dive into issues relating to the GCF. So we found that adaptation projects are harder to fund for the private sector because they're considered as being riskier. So when I'm saying risks, it's political risks with investing in certain countries or technological risks that are associated with new innovations. And then there's incertitude around return on investment or the weaker business case vis-a-vis mitigation. So this is particularly true in new and unproven markets or countries that are just typically not popular for investing, which are countries that are eligible to access GCF funds typically. So I just wanted to give a concrete example on that. If we're talking about building a seawall, it's quite hard to quantify the benefits of this seawall. So it might be a seawall that provides protection to a low-lying coastal community from storm surges, whereas the monetary benefits of solar energy generation are clear. You generate energy that you can sell, so there's a strong business case. Therefore, the private sector is interested. A seawall will provide long-term indirect benefits for the common good, the community, but it doesn't necessarily have a direct monetary return. So for that reason, adaptation projects are predominantly funded via grants. So that's money that doesn't need to be paid back, where mitigation projects are more readily funded through loans and equity. Another challenge, particularly relevant to private sector accessing funds from funding bodies such as GCF, is that it's a very resource-intensive process. We've noticed that the timing and the complexity of developing a climate change project is a real barrier for the private sector, particularly for small and medium enterprises. This is problematic because SMEs account for the vast majority of businesses in regions where the GCF operates. For example, in Africa, 90% of all businesses are SMEs. And Rashmi, you mentioned as well that 95% of SMEs globally is a private sector. So that attests to that. So when I'm talking about complexity to access funding from the GCF, one example is if you're an organization and you want to access GCF funds, you need to be accredited. This is a very lengthy process. Your books need to be in order. You need to comply with environmental and social standards, etc. Also, the development of a proposal to submit to the GCF is a big undertaking. Sometimes it takes years to design a project. The documents and requirements are extensive. You need to collect data for the climate reasoning. You need to do climate economic modeling, barrier assessment, policy review, gender assessment, action plan. just to name a few. And then, of course, another challenge is data. So data can be really hard to get hold of, which makes it hard for investors to assess the costs and benefits of activities. Political instability in some countries can hold up the process too. So that just makes it very unappealing for the private sector. And obviously, it's clear that this is a resource-intensive process. Why would a private sector entity invest when you're really not sure that the project will materialize and when? So when will there be a return on investment? So as you can imagine, the upfront costs of designing a project just makes it extremely challenging for SMEs to partner with the GCF.
Your explanation of the accreditation process is really spot on, and it really reminded me of a talk we had with an entrepreneur during our project with Onido, who provided solutions for clean and safe drinking water. And he was really desperate, as investors want to have all this kind of data, and he needs their money first to set up all the structures to provide this data. So that stuck to my mind. And also, you mentioned that it's really difficult to quantify and monetize A&R benefits. And this might also be connected to one other finding that I found really surprising during our project. And that was that entrepreneurs and SMEs were often not really aware of their contribution to A&R, which kind of goes in hand with the broad A&R solution examples from Rashmi earlier, as we might not think about the connection firsthand. But there was, for instance, a medical company that connected emergency medical resources so that help can be accessed faster, which also helps in natural disasters, right? So it has a connection to A&R. But at the end, it was the Catalyst Fund who helped them as an accelerator, making this connection to adaptation and resilience. And this also means that even when there's A&R funding, startups might not apply to it, even though they have a connection. So this really made me think that it's very important to look kind of beyond this initial A&R bubble. And to close it, one term from the interviews that really stick to my mind was accelerator darlings, which means that there's diverse solutions overall, but it's always the same entrepreneurs and SMEs that get into the accelerator programs over and over again. And it's not the broader landscape that gets the funding. So I like that term a lot. And Helen, you indicated earlier that GCF also tries to attract private sector financing to close the finance gap. Could you elaborate on how they are doing that?
Yes, engaging the private sector is a big part of GCF's approach to get more funding for adaptation projects and activities. So, one key goals of the GCF when it was established was to catalyze funding from the private sector to climate change projects, and it's in a good position to do so. It's got a great global reputation and the ability to de-risk private investments. However, according to, again, a GCF insight we did looking into the topic of private sector engagement in 2022 with the GCF, only 21% of projects were private sector projects. So that's 42 out of 200. And out of 10.8 billion committed to the GCF, only 3.7 billion US of GCF total financing is from the private sector. So there's quite a bit of work to be done on that front. The GCF has established a private sector facility, and the point of this facility is to really hone in on and address barriers to private sector investment in climate change mitigation and adaptation activities in vulnerable countries. So the private sector facilities has been able to make climate projects less riskier and therefore more appealing to invest in. And this has been done by a number of means, including providing blended finance, first loss guarantees, results-based payments, grants, etc. On this topic of accreditation, actually, what is a part of the private sector facility, what they have done to entice the private sector is that they've introduced a project-by-project accreditation. So that means you've got a project, you just get accredited for that project, as opposed to going through the whole one organization getting accredited to access money. So this should be easing the burden for private sector entities to access GCF funding. So a lot less paperwork.
Great. And it's also good to hear that they are going into this blended finance options as they are becoming more and more relevant for A&R. And taking a glimpse maybe beyond the financing challenges, Rashmi, in your daily interactions with SMEs providing A&I solutions, what are the challenges they face?
Yeah, so looking at some of the common hurdles faced by these climate adaptation and resilience SMEs, so we see that they are being challenged to make a strong link between the business case and between the adaptation and resilience rationale. So this is why we help them in the first phase to refine that and to be very clear on how their solution is contributing to the rationale. And the second one is they lack access to specific expertise, because developing effective climate adaptation solutions requires specialized knowledge and technical expertise tailored to the needs of the vulnerable communities. But accessing this expertise is quite challenging without a deep understanding of the users' needs and vulnerabilities to climate change impacts. So this is very crucial, and which is commonly lacking across these different innovators. And as Marlene mentioned earlier, so there are these solutions which go into these various accelerators, and it's difficult to get out of those accelerators to attract private sector investment, which goes beyond a grant. And they also lack access to networks as well as learning. So these innovators who are working worldwide tirelessly to develop climate adaptation solutions, but they have a problem in also learning or sharing knowledge from others in the field. So this is why it is very important that they feel supported to share evidence of what works and how to scale their solutions, so that the other sectors can also learn from these innovators to accelerate progress across the sector.
It is really great to hear that you and Onido are supporting SMEs to overcome these challenges. And I really appreciated working with you, all the spirit that you bring. That was really, really great. And to maybe better understand the projects that you're doing, could you give us an example?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So today I'm going to be sharing an example from a project which is called Accelerating FinTech for Climate Resilience. So this groundbreaking initiative is made possible thanks to the funding from the Global Environment Facility. So this is a pilot project which aims to demonstrate that climate resilience can be integrated into FinTech and digital tech solutions, particularly in five African countries. So they are Kenya, Nigeria, Uganda, Rwanda, as well as South Africa. So through this project, we're turbocharging startup-led solutions by providing catalytic capital, tailored venture building support, mentoring, and networks. So what is our goal? So the goal is to de-risk investments for future investors and to enhance the value proposition offered by these companies, ultimately fueling growth and improving climate adaptation and resilience.
How does this support concretely look like?
So the startups who are participating in this program will receive $100,000 worth of tailored venture building support from the JEF through the Catalyst Fund, who is our partner. And additionally, on top of this, once the venture building support is absorbed by the company, Catalyst Fund provides an additional $100,000 of investment through an innovative financing instrument called a SAFE Note, which is an expansion for a simple agreement for future equity, which allows or offers a low risk alternative to cash grants. So this is sort of a catalyst to attract further private sector investment to help these companies towards the commercialization journey. But it is not all smooth sailing for inclusive fintech startups. They do face challenges such as reaching out to vulnerable populations, investor risk aversion, and a lack of suitable financing instruments. So this project addresses these hurdles head-on, focusing on tech-enabled innovation and climate resilience impact.
How do you choose the businesses for the project? And what are the criteria you apply in the selection?
Yes, so our partner, the Catalyst Fund, is looking for startups with innovative fintech-enabled products and business models that improve affordability, accessibility, and appropriateness. So these startups develop climate resilience solutions for underserved individuals as well as small businesses that are vulnerable to climate change impacts, with a preference for directly impacting women and other at-risk groups. So our criteria also emphasizes traction and scalability, with startups already demonstrating potential to scale within their markets. And additionally, we prioritize diversity with a strong preference for local entrepreneurs and women founders or co-founders.
Thank you so much for this example, Rashmi. Before we close it, I would like to ask you if you believe that it's feasible to increase the private sector financing for adaptation and resilience in the near future. What do you say to that, Rashmi?
Absolutely. I'm completely optimistic about the potential for increased private sector financing in the realm of adaptation and resilience solutions. So here at Unido, we're keeping a positive outlook. While there's no denying that there are challenges ahead, we're quite excited about the possibilities offered by blended finance models. So these models, in particular, are essential for testing and improving solutions, especially in developing countries, ultimately driving scalability for climate adaptation and resilience efforts.
I'm with Rashmi on this one. I'm optimistic, it's feasible, and it's just so necessary. There's such an urgent need to break down the barriers for the private sector to really unlock flows of private finance to meet the pressing adaptation needs of the global South today, who are disproportionately and in a very unjust way bearing the brunt of climate change. Not only that, it's really the most vulnerable people and communities who are impacted the most. As I've mentioned, the GCF is definitely making some progress in addressing the barriers that the private sector has faced when investing in climate change activities. But of course, there is just so much more to be done.
To close this enriching conversation, I would like to do a lightning round, which means that I will throw in a term or a word which came up in the discussion today, and you can provide a nearly instantaneous kind of gut reaction to that. Are you ready for this?
Yes, let's do it.
I'm nervous.
Okay, first one, climate justice.
Needed.
Yeah, I'm speechless. Just so incredibly important.
That's true. Empowerment.
I would say creativity.
Great. Interconnectedness.
Cracking under the pressure is needed.
Learning opportunities.
Responsibility.
Of the global north to the global south. Climate justice, yeah.
I would say flexibility also comes with responsibility for all of these various actors to be open to trying new things to make more climate adaptation solutions available.
That's so nice, Rashmi.
Yeah, that's
You're
great.
nailing this.
And challenges.
Abundant.
I would say motivation to do more.
Great, that's great. Maybe one last one to end with solutions.
I would say partnerships.
I'd say innovation.
Wow, that's great. So, to wrap up today's episode, we can conclude that SMEs and entrepreneurs are really vital for the local economies, but also for the A&R sector, especially in developing countries. And they're already providing a wide range of solutions from agriculture, financial services, blue economy, urban or health solutions. Unfortunately, there is much more mitigation than adaptation funding available, and entrepreneurs really struggle to get funding due to several reasons, such as the challenges to quantify and monetize A&R solutions, the enormous effort needed for funding accreditation, and also investors' perceived risk towards A&R solutions in developing countries. But it is also really good to see already progress, such as from GCF, that aims to distribute funding equally for mitigation and adaptation, and supports private sector funding by things like blended finance models. And also, we saw a great example of multilateral organization, as Unido, that tries to create a landscape that enables entrepreneurs to convert their really enormous potential. But in all these efforts done, we should really keep in mind that adaptation solutions are highly context specific and that the focus should not primarily be on groundbreaking innovations, but also supporting often simple and proven solutions that local communities came up with. To close it for today, thank you to Helen and Rashmi. It was an honor to have you here in the podcast, and it was great to hear all your insights today. To the listeners, I hope that this episode sparked some thoughts in you today and that it inspired you to contribute to raising awareness for this really critical issue. See you next time.